black autobiography, Growing Up Black in the USA, as looked at by all of us, and so far as I look around the room, none of us are black. Yeah, I need that one if you would. The handouts are coming here. We got some extra. Yeah, they're coming around. Okay, we've got, if you don't have one, you can look on to somebody, and I will, just parts of them we're going to look at anyway, so I think we'll all be okay. Obviously, I'm white, and I sure can't be an expert on growing up black in the USA. And as I look at this room, neither can any of us. But what we can do is increase the sensitivity to and an awareness of that whole dimension of our culture. And as we gain an appreciation of and a sensitivity to that dimension of our culture, I guess this is one of the motivating things for me as a student and a teacher of literature, is that we gain an appreciation and sensitivity to all our sisters and brothers. And this is part of that. It's a dimension into the other selves, you know, out of ourself into someone else. And that's always, that's part of our Christian journey, and that's part of our humane journey, and those two, of course, go together. Well, the sense of this today is to look together and have you listen to some of the real vibrant stuff that comes from black autobiography, because I think that, especially those of you who have been in some of the sessions throughout the week, we read a lot of oppressive stuff and depressing stuff. And I think I mentioned in one class that I had a parent, and it happens more, it happens sort of frequently, that a parent will say, how do you teach this stuff? It's so depressing. And my response to that is always that the author's act of writing is an act of affirmation of life, it's an act of celebration, it's an act of love, and it's an act of hope. If the black experience in America and any kind of injustice were of total despair, who would bother to write a book? Who would bother to create a song? Who would bother to write the poem and on it goes with the forms of art that celebrate, in fact, in spite of oppression? Well, that's the kind of thing we'll do today. And the perspective that I'll try to bring to this with your help in our discussion of this is to move quickly out of the historical and the general into the real, specific, and the personal. The way to start that, I think, is to first quickly look at 45 events that changed you and your world. This was in Ebony Magazine last year to celebrate their 45th anniversary, and they just went through and did, as these Xerox copies show, 45 events, historical events, and then finally 45 years in culture and creative writing. If you'd like to read any of that, you're welcome to do that, and we won't do it here, and take it out of this class, and then just bring it back. And maybe the place to put that, if you take it, and if you're not interested, that's fine, let's just set it up on top of the piano when you're done, so we can get them back and use those in the future if we get to and have that chance. Well, a couple of these things and 45 events that changed you and your world, I'd just like to point out. First off, let's take a look at 1954. That's event number 9. May 17th, 1954, the Supreme Court hands down the landmark Brown versus Board of Education decision, which declared segregation in public schools unconstitutional. You know, a lot of us were, and I look around, probably all of us were around in 1954. We're not so far ahead of that abominable government in South Africa that we are quick to jump on. I mean, they are just now ending apartheid, and we had apartheid as bad as South Africa does now. And I think this 1954 landmark decision that outlaws segregation in a way, in our language of how we follow it today, outlaws apartheid. Because go back to 1896, which is not in this because that's not 45 years. In 1896, the Supreme Court decision, Plessy versus Ferguson, created the, anybody know that? Separate but
equal.
And of course, separate turned out to be not very equal at all, and then that leads to the 54 decision. What's, I think, significant about that is that 1896 to 1954 add them up. That's a long time. And those of you who listen to us talk about Martin Luther King essay that's found in the book with a great title, Why We Can't Wait, they've been waiting a long time historically. And that big kind of historical perspective puts an umbrella over the personal responses that you'll hear in a minute and that we'll look at together. Then, just right after that is 1955. We all know about this, but it's just a kind of a nice reminder. Number 12, December 5th, 1955. The historic bus boycott begins in Montgomery, Alabama, precipitated by the arrest of Rosa Parks, a seamstress and activist who refused to give her seat to a white man on a Montgomery bus. We'll listen to some, you know, some personal, and I'll put that on there, because we're going to move, as I said, from historical to personal, even intimate. And as a literature teacher, I guess I believe that the only way to study history is intimately. I mean, you have to read the autobiographies. You can't just read the big sweeping dates in the military. That's what we've done, right? That's what we all did in high school and in college, too. And it doesn't give us much grasp of history at all. In fact, it just skims over a whole lot of truths that we'll get a sense of as we look at the personal and the intimate. I say that right now. Think not only of the guts, the courage it took for Rosa Parks to make that act. Think of the vision it took. What else did it take? I mean, since 1896, separate but equal has been the law of the land. It's still the law of the land until 1954, and then a year later, but it's still part of the culture. And here's this black woman who has been sitting on the bus for all her life. I think she was about 30 when she did this. Anybody know that for sure? Anyway, pretty young. And the white man came along, and finally, she said, no, I'm going to stay here. What does it take to do that?
I think it takes some good feelings of self-worth that she's just as good as any other person, and she has every right to stay in whatever seat she wants.
Great word. Phrase, self-worth. Terrific. We're going to look at that and listen for that as we look at autobiography and the intimate revealings of these people who write these autobiographies. Self-worth doesn't come easy in the black community.
It takes a lot of courage.
Yep. And we'll look at it as all this part of, it's for sure it's in our genes, and that we can talk about this forever and we won't. It's in our genes, but isn't it a big part of our environment too? I mean, that's what we hear as a teacher, and those of you who, in any kind of communicating type profession, the name of the game is positive reinforcement, and to reinforce and to build courage in students and confidence and so on. The black experience hasn't lent itself to that throughout our culture and history.
Wasn't she just so tired?
Sure.
She was just sick and tired of... sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Sick and, that's nice. Sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I just wrote King's book, Why We Can't Wait. We've waited a lot. His says, we've waited 340 years, folks. Okay, good. Anything else?
It took an awful lot of commitment, I think, because how did she know, or didn't she have fear in her mind that with what this fellow would have picked her up and threw her out of the seat?
Yep.
It could happen down
yep.
there.
And the way you put that, I'll write the word commitment to her own causes and principles and the risk she took. Yeah.
You know, there might be a little other twist to it, too, because isn't it the case that she was looking at a clean woman and was sick and tired more than she's physically? And I was like, she didn't want to fight. I mean, there's another side of it almost. She just got on the bus, sat down, and said, whatever happens, happens.
Yeah.
But I physically can't move.
Yeah. That's very good, and in fact, again, Martin Luther King in that essay, Letter from Birmingham Jail, that some of us looked at together a couple days ago, and whether you did or didn't, that won't matter for this, but he says that just laws must square with natural law, and we talked about in that natural law means when you're tired, you rest. And if there's a law that says that you're tired, you can't rest, you got to get up and get your seat, that's a law that's got to be violated. I mean, and disobeyed. That's civil disobedience at its best. And that's commitment and good. Anything else?
I'm sure there was anger underneath that gave her courage.
Good. And as white folks, I mean, I look around this room, we wonder. I mean, I can remember sitting in front of the television set with my mother beside me and my dad on the other side, watching Detroit downtown burn on the television screen. And my mom says, what are they burning their own houses for? We didn't know. You know, and well, we come to know, don't we? There's anger. And those own houses aren't their own houses, and we all know about that now. But then, that was kind of the white American response. What are they doing in there? Anger, good. Anything else? Enough then. That's the general historical kind of look at some of these big events, and you can just kind of whip through those at your own. And it's just interesting to learn that there are some profound changes brought about in our country by black people, and that's an eye-opener in itself to many people. Okay, then it's time to get out my glasses. I too. And just start with some of the stories of what the black experience has been like. And I haven't picked anything long. I don't think it'll put you to sleep. But if it does, if you know, say, just stop me and say, let's not read, let's not listen anymore. And you probably won't have enough courage to do that. But I'll know. If you're in, okay. But I don't think it'll happen. This is a whole collection of very short slave narratives. Man, folks that didn't go through slavery ain't got no idea what it was. I reckon there must have been 100 colored folks in that trader yard. And the dirt and smell was terrible, terrible. I was just like a little chap, and like I told you, but I can't remember that place like it happened yesterday. Husbands sold away from wives and children taken away from their mothers. A trader them days didn't think no more of selling a baby or a little child away from its mother than taking a little calf away from a cow. I recollect the night after Mary is sold away from us, the colored folks in the trader yard hold prayer meeting. Mama was very religious, and if ever a soul went to heaven, hers did. Seems like Major Long was gone that evening, and Mama and some more of the folks in the yard got together for a praying time. Didn't do no singing, because that would have attracted attention, and the Major didn't allow no prayer meetings. But someone saw the folks praying and told him the next morning, and he come out in the yard with a cat of nine tails and rounds everybody up, and then he said, "You niggers what was praying last night, step out here." I remember well how the roads was full of folks walking and walking along when the niggers were freed. Didn't know where they was going. Just going to see about something else somewhere else. Meet a body in the road and they ask, "Where you going?" "Don't know." "What are you going to do?" "Don't know." And then sometimes we'd meet a white man and he would say, "How you like to come work on my farm?" And we say, "I don't know." And then maybe he say, "If you come work for me on my farm when the crops is in, I give you 5 bushels of corn, 5 gallons of molasses, some ham meat, and all your clothes and victuals while you works for me." "All right, that's what I do." And then something begins to work up here, and I begin to think and to know things. And I know then I could make a living for my own self. And I never had to be a slave no more. The 100 years ago, 150. Slaves are freed, and we have no concept of what that must have been like. I think I pointed out in one of the other classes, but I'll just remind you, it's in the bookstore, the story of Beloved. And Beloved, the main character in that novel is an escaped slave, and she's escaped up to her mother-in-law's house. And she gets up the first day after arriving there, and there's a short paragraph, I'll never forget it, describing her thoughts on, "I don't know what to do today. I get to choose what I'm going to do. I can do nothing, or I can help Mom and us." This little paragraph just knocked me out of my socks, knowing that this is a, what do I do today? She's never had that option in her life. "Where are you going?" "Don't know." "What you going to do?" "Don't know." Well, the intimacy of that puts a little different perspective on the history of it all, doesn't it? And we'll see as we go how that grows into a whole kind of special character and a special kind of celebration about life. One more from the slave narratives.
I have to get back here and stand under this light.
Slavery was the worst days that was ever seen in the world. They was things past telling, but I got the scars on my old body to show this day. I seed worse than what happened to me. I seed them put the men and the women in the stock with their hands screwed down through the holes in the boards and their feet tied together and they naked behinds to the world. Solomon, the overseer, beat them with a big whip and Massa, look on. The niggers better not stop in the fields when they hear them yelling. They cut the flesh, most of the bones, and some they was. When they'd taken them out of stock and put them on the beds, they never got up again. And then listen to this paragraph carefully. When a nigger died, they let his folks come out the fields to see him before he died. They buried him the same day. Take a big plank and bust it with an axe in the middle enough to bend it back and put the dead nigger in betwixt it. They'd cart him down to the graveyard on the place and not bury him deep enough that buzzards wouldn't come circling around. Niggers mourns now, but in them days, they wasn't no time for mourning. Wow. How do you create? Look at the things that we've written up here about this respiratory spot. Self-worth and courage and anger and tiredness and commitment and risk. And how does that all get created? And what are the responses that can come out of an environment that has been so powerful and poignant as this is? The conch shell blowed afore daylight and all, afore daylight. You've heard that phrase, up before dawn and back to sleep after dusk. The conch shell blowed afore daylight and all the hands better get out for roll call or Solomon bust the door down and get them out. It was work hard getting beatens and half fed. They brung the victuals and water to the fields on a slide pulled by an old mule. Plenty times there was only half a barrel of water and it's stale and hot. For all us niggers on the hottest days. Mostly we ate pickled pork and cornbread and peas and beans and taters. They never was as much as we needed. The time I hated the most was picking cotton when the frost was on the bowls. My hand would get sore and crack open and bleed, and we'd have a little fire in the fields, and if in the ones with tender hands couldn't stand it no longer, we'd run and warm our hands a little bit. When I couldn't steal a tater, I used to slip it in the ashes, and when I'd run to the fire, I'd take it out and eat it on the sly. Well, it's not all so despairing. This wonderful, in some ways fictionalized, but it doesn't matter, fiction still tells the truth, autobiography by Richard Wright called Black Boy has some stories now that I'd like to take us through from this historical look that we just started on with slavery and incorporate how we are part of this too. Whether we've ever participated, and none of us has, in the black experience directly, we still are a part of that. And we watch it, or if we don't even know about it, it still is infiltrating into our culture and into our responses and into, in fact, defining really who and what we are. Growing Up Black in America is what the title of this session is. Richard Wright opens this wonderful little autobiography with with this story about he's sitting around with his brother in the house. He doesn't have anything to do. And the curiosity is growing, and he's getting more and more impatient, and he's a real little kid. And he decides that it might be interesting if he could take this broom straw from the next to the fireplace, light it, and put it up to the curtains and see what would happen. I mean, this house is built like a... only not nearly as nice, but it's as dry as a Holden chalet. Okay? and you know, it's going to go. Well, it does. Don't do that, my brother said. How come? You'll burn the whole broom. You hush, I said. I'll tell, and I'll hit you. Parents, you ever heard that in your house? You know, it just that little aside there. It's interesting, and you'll hear it, how when you get into the common folk life, the intimacy of these people, they have the same dreams and the same hopes and the same aspirations and the same troubles and the same households that we do in lots of ways. And I'll hit you, I said. My idea was growing, blooming. Now I was wondering just how the long, fluffy white curtains would look if I lit a bunch of straws and held it under them. Would I try it? Sure. I pulled several straws from the broom and held them to the fire until they blazed. I rushed to the window and brought the flame in touch with the hems of the curtains. My brother shook his head. No, he said. He spoke too late. Red circles were eating into the white cloth, and then a flare of flame shot out. Startled, I backed away. The fire started to soar to the ceiling, and I trembled with fright. Soon a sheet of yellow lit the room. I was terrified. I wanted to scream, but was afraid. I looked around for my brother. He was gone. One half of the room was now ablaze. Smoke was choking me, and the fire was looking at my face, making me gasp. Well, the house burns down. And he runs and hides under the porch of a neighbor house, and his mother is frantic because she can't find him. And guess where she thinks he is? In the house, and my kid's burned to death. But she finds him. You know the old phrase, you don't want to lump or lick him, you know? Well, she licks him. And it's a different kind of licking than maybe we've ever experienced. And here's his description of that. "You almost scared us to death," my mother muttered as she stripped the leaves from a tree limb to prepare it for my back. "I was lashed so hard and long that I lost consciousness. I was beaten out of my senses, and later I found myself in bed, screaming, determined to run away, tussling with my mother and father who were trying to keep me still. I was lost in a fog of fear. A doctor was called, I was afterwards told, and he ordered that I be kept to bed and I be kept quiet, that my very life depended upon it. My body seemed on fire and I couldn't sleep. Packs of ice were put on my forehead to keep down the fever. Whenever I tried to sleep, I would see huge wobbly white bags like the full udders of cows suspended from the ceiling above me. Later, as I grew worse, I could see the bags in the daytime with my eyes open, and I was gripped by the fear that they were going to fall and drench me with some horrible liquid. Day and night, I begged my mother and father to take the bags away, pointing to them, shaking with terror, because no one else saw them. Exhaustion would make me drift towards sleep, and then I would scream until I was wide awake again. I was afraid to sleep. Time finally bore me away from the dangerous bags, and I got well. But for a long time, I was chastened whenever I remembered that my mother had come close to killing me." It's an unfair question without having read the whole book, but I'm going to ask it anyway. The language that the writer uses, now he's an adult recalling his childhood. He recalls the childhood experience. That's autobiography. But then there's insight into culture and the development of human nature that's brought to that recall by the adult now writing. And the words, why would you remember them, were, my ideas were growing, blooming, I was wondering. He's got this idea, and I can do something with some vision. And why does his mother beat him so bad? Why does he open with that kind of a story? Again, it's a terrible question outside of the...
without being beaten down to conform.
Exactly. Beaten down to conform in the language that mother uses throughout this book. He is beaten all the time. Stay in your place. And one occasion, Richard goes out and he gets in a fight with some black kids. Excuse me, and they take his money, his grocery money, beat him up and send him home. And his mother says, "Here's $10 and here's a stick. And you go out there and you fight those guys and you come back with the groceries. And don't come back until you've won." And he goes out, he swings the stick and he wins. And he kind of becomes the king of the yard, the king of the block. And he comes back with the groceries and mother says, "Good." A little bit later, he gets in a fight with some white kids and he comes, they threw a glass bottle at him and they cut his head. And he comes home and she dabs it and she beats him. Don't you ever fight with white kids again. Why? Stay in your place. The blacks you can fight. But if you want to make it in this world, you have to stay in your place. And too much wonder in that first scene, too much vision, too much, "I'm not going to give my seat to you, sir," is going to get you in big trouble. And indeed, Rosa Parks is arrested. And indeed, Martin Luther King and lots of other people in that whole civil rights, civil disobedience movement are arrested or beaten or killed. Well, early on, that's the opening of this autobiography, Wright learns that's the position. That's what I've got to do.
Even to this day, though, there's a fair amount of violence of black parents against their children. I had a father when I was a teacher, well, I'm still a teacher in Minneapolis, that came to school and was so angry that she had stole things out of my desk. The other kids came in my room and said, Zagantia's father is beating her up in the hallway. And I mean, we had to go and get someone to stop it. And I wonder why is that continued? Because I've never had a white parent or an American Indian parent or a Hmong parent or a Vietnamese parent, you know, use the physical violence. And I've had other parents say that if I couldn't handle the child, to give them a call, they'd come over to school and whip the kids' butt right in school. Which, of course, they don't take them up on. But I mean, it's that attitude that, you know, we'll come over and that's the way they see they can be helpful.
I wouldn't attempt to answer that question without statistics. And I don't have those statistics. There is, however, in black literature, African American literature, there's a pretty constant theme over and over again of this idea of, you know, you better conform to survive. And the mother beats this kid out of love. I want you to stay alive. Look what she said. You get out there and fight those black kids. But then when she starts fighting white kids, she beats him up and said, don't you ever, that's the call. Don't ever fight with white kids again. You can't fight, because you can take on one kid, but as soon as you fight one, the whites, who are you taking on? The whole system. So however that illustration fits what your observation is, make of it what you will, I would be hesitant to. An historical, cultural, sweeping generalization is different from a personal observation, and the observation is Richard Wright's. This is my personal life, and out of that, this is what I have become. In his case, mom beats him to keep him alive, to keep him in his place. How many people do that?
Okay, so you're not applying this to, as a generality?
I sure don't mean to be.
Okay, so
yeah. Yeah, well, that's good. Thank you for clarifying that then. And I think that's precisely why we have we have black literature courses and we have a session like this. Is to get into, we can make some historical generalizations if we want to, but we have to be real careful about those and just say, well, I know this is a specific incident and this is a specific person. And here's a phrase for me, you know, kind of pedagogically in education that works. What starts out to be issues of justice, and that is that what general things can you say about the black condition in America? The more you look into that, it becomes actions of love or issues of love. Justice is an historical, sweeping, group, community kind of thing. Love becomes a personal, intimate kind of thing. And you love the characters of the autobiography. And the love, does this make sense? That you have for that character moves out into a bigger kind of justice arena. You know, gee, this isn't fair that Wright should have to, and then I move out into, in my own action anyway, we do. Into something of justice. Maybe that'll clarify as we go further along. I don't know. I'm really glad you said that and clarified that for us, though. Thank you. Yeah, well, for mine too, and ours, all of us too. So in a minute, it gets even more, I think, interesting how white people get brought into this. I don't know how to answer that either, except I'll do it real specifically. Richard Wright didn't beat his kids. He was not an abuser. So I'm one, this is a question. And you people who are, there are people out here, I'm probably out here in the audience, there's experts in everything, that might be experts on this. Wright was abused, not out of a mother's personality in idiosyncrasies. He was abused to help him survive. She had a real deliberate purpose, and it wasn't her personality gone wild or her emotions or, you know, does that make sense? And that might be different. And so Richard Wright, when he's up and he's got grown up and he has two kids, he doesn't have those conditions anymore to beat his kids down to teach them to survive. In fact, I'll speak about black poetry in general. It doesn't beat down at all. It lifts up. Because, you know, black pride instead of black keeping your place. And maybe that's a whole generational change. Does that make sense? Sandy has been cutting out coupons for this amusement park for weeks. And the kids, Sandy's black, of course, and the kids are going to go to the amusement park, and they do, three kids together. It was a long walk to the park, and Willie Mae stopped and took off her shoes and stockings, and they're brand new, and they were pinching her toes, and carried them in her hands until she got near the gate. Then she put them on again and limped bravely along. Now get the scene here. They've been cutting coupons. This little girl's got her new shoes on, her new dress, and they're going to go to the amusement park, and they're really fired up for this, and, you know, it's been a big thing in their life. She limped along bravely, clutching her precious bits of newspaper coupons. They could hear the band playing and the children shouting and squealing as the cars and the chute-to-chutes shot downward with a splash into the pond. They could see the giant Ferris wheel, larger than the one the carnival had had, circling high in the air. "I'm going to ride on that one first," said Sandy. There were crowds of children under the bright red and white wooden shelter at the park entrance. They were lining up at the gate, laughing, merry, clean little white children, pushing and yelling and giggling amiably. Sandy let Willie Mae go first, and he got in line behind her. The band was playing gaily inside. They were almost to the entrance now. There were just two boys in front of them. Willie Mae held out her black little hand, clutching the coupons. They moved forward. The man looked down. "Sorry," he said. "This party's for white kids." Willie Mae did not understand. She stood holding out the coupons, waiting for the tall white man to take them. "Stand back now, you two," he said, not unkindly, looking at Sandy as well. "I told you little darkies this wasn't your party. Come on, next little girl." Notice he said not unkindly. "Then kick him out. Come on, move on." And the line of white children pushed past Willie Mae and Sandy going into the park. Stunned, the two dark ones drew aside. Then they noticed a group of a dozen or more other colored youngsters standing apart in the sun just without the bright entrance, the entrance pavilion, and among them was Sadie Butler, Sandy's classmate. Three or four of the colored children were crying, but most of them looked sullen and angry, and some of them had turned to go home. "My papa takes the leader, and you see what it says here on the coupons, too? Free admittance to every child in Stanton. Can't you read it, Sandy?" "Sure, I can read it. I guess they didn't mean colored. They wouldn't let us in." Willie Mae, between the painful shoes and the hurt of her disappointment, was on the verge of tears. One of the small boys in the crowd, a hard-looking little fellow from Pearl Street, was cursing childish. "Goddamn old sons of biscuit eaters, that's what they are. I wish I was a big man, doggone. I'd shoot them all, that's what I'd do." "I suppose they didn't mean colored kids," said Sandy again. They walked. I mean, that's a powerful scene. They walked there with Earl, too. And I'm going to introduce Earl to you now. Earl's a white kid, and he's Sandy's close friend. We've had two illustrations here, and I'll end here, and we can share this. The teacher sit in the back, and the white man, who said not unkindly, "This is for white kids." Now Earl, who's also 10, is with them. Willie Mae walked away, followed by, Sadie. Walked away, followed by five or six other little girls in their Sunday dresses. Willie Mae was sitting on the ground, taking off her shoes again, sweat and tears running down her black cheeks. Sandy saw his white schoolmate, Earl, approaching. "What's the matter, Sandy? Ain't you going in?" Earl demanded, looking at his friend's worried face. "Did Willie Mae hurt her foot?" "No," said Sandy. "We just ain't going in." "Here, Earl, you can have my coupons. If you have extra ones, the paper says you can get some lemonade, so you take them." The white boy, puzzled, accepted the offered coupons, stood dumbly for a moment, wondering what to say to his brown friend, and then went on into the park. History and the intimate personality come together. What do you make of those two stories, the teacher, the ticket taker, and little Earl? Just in your guts.
I think they're representative of the more idea of attitudes.
Yeah, good. A variety of attitudes. You in the back. And then, not unkindly, you can't come in here.
How many black people are in the Lutheran church?
Not very many. We know that.
In the individual congregation.
Yeah.
A lot of subtle discrimination there, even by the person that said kindly, "This is not for."
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's just a case in Minneapolis now against Dayton's by a black man that's very well educated saying how he was harassed trying to shop at a major department store, and now other people are coming forward. And the stories are just horrendous of people being strip searched and beaten. I mean, just trying to shop when they had money.
Yep. So, good. Subtle is a good word there.
Well, that's what came out in the articles, was that there's a real subtle message going out to society that if you're black, don't bother to shop here, don't bother to come here. Yeah. You know, you're not really wanted.
Go to Zares.
Yeah.
If you read This Was Then, That Was Now, you'll find that the poor, white poor, experience some of the exact same things that Richard Wright's talking about, also, the subtle discrimination. Mm-hmm. And the family, again, putting them back into their place because they shouldn't associate.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Okay. In the white shirt, I wish I knew everybody's name.
I have a godchild that's half black in Greenbelt, Maryland. And I took him to buy some new clothes because he was coming out to the Pacific Lutheran. He had won a scholarship or something. He's 15 years old. So we're in the store, and, you know, 15-year-olds are doing all the shopping. And I'm going and buying this great outfit. And he came to get me and said, that woman's not going to let me try on clothes. I said, what do you mean? And he said, they haven't noticed I'm black, and they don't think I'm going to buy. And sure enough, the woman was not going to let him go into the dressing room to try on those clothes because this black kid wasn't going to buy in this white store. And that's where the kid lived. Second incident is he's very large for a 15-year-old. And he says, the police are following me everywhere in Reno. Every time he walks down the street, he says, I'm beginning to see that the police want to know where I am, what I'm doing, and why I'm here.
It's a white community primarily?
Well, about 15% black.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Mostly really white that are seen. So it's really no different.
Yeah.
It's living exactly the same, and the messages we're giving is exactly the same.
1991.
And Nathan's buying it. He doesn't know where he fits. He already doesn't know where he fits because he's black white. And he's decided he's black by how he dresses and how he's developed. And now he's rethinking it.
Even what? The desegregation we have isn't working very well. Minneapolis started a black academy this year for a select number of black children staffed by black teachers, social workers, administrators, because black children are not doing well in public schools in big cities across the country. Many school systems now are starting, this is just a half a day thing where kids go there for a half a day, but they saw grades of kids who had not been very interested and school goes going up, and so now it looks like there's going to be some voluntary segregation for at least part of the day.
What do you make of Earl in this? Before we go here, you know, people are going to leave for lunch. Earl.
He's too young to really understand the discrimination, I think.
Doesn't understand, but participates in it. And
unwittingly,
right. The teacher knows better, and we scold her. And the guy at the gate, he knows better too, and he could do something, something radical, that's for sure. But he doesn't. And little Earl, he participates too. And he's going to grow up to be, you know, he'll be kind to black people, won't he? But he'll also perpetuate this.